Today's edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you in part by NEC. NEC Corporation is a leading provider and integrator of IT and networking technologies around the world. NEC's OpenFlow-based software-defined networking fabric, Programmable Flow, radically simplifies network design and management, increases network performance and predictability, speeds innovation, and dramatically reduces the cost of network operations. Visit NEC Corporation of America on the web at www.necam.com/pflow and download a free white paper from IDC on designing networks with OpenFlow, or contact your NEC representative today for more information on how an OpenFlow-enabled network fabric can solve your networking challenges.
Welcome everyone to the Packet Pushers podcast, and tonight we are having our very first packet party. An idea we were tossing around, and we decided that we wanted to have an open format, sort of a live event, where you can ask questions and someone, maybe even us, will be able, or hopefully able, to answer your questions. We want you to raise topics, events, problems, something in the news that you'd like us to talk about, and then we'll throw it open to the microphone. Here's how it's going to work. The GoToMeeting software, which you've got there, there's a button which says you can raise your hand. If you have the ability to talk to us, hopefully you've got a headset plugged in on your computer, or if those people who are on the telephone, which is kind of quaint, but there you go, then enable your microphone, raise your hand, and then we will put you on the mic and listen and talk to anybody who wants to raise a question. There's also a chat window where you can actually send in questions to us. We all have the ability to see that. So all the panelists that are with us today, Ivan, we've got Derek Winkworth, Jeremy Gaddis, have all got the ability to see the questions, and then they should be able to pipe up and join in. So let's go around the table and welcome everybody here. Of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as at etherealmind. You probably know me because you've listened to me all the time. How are you, Mr. Ethan Banks?
Good. Designing stuff, doing things, and had one of those weeks where a lot of people were calling me for a problem that was someone else's. So I'm glad it's Friday because I'm tired of saying, yeah, you got to call this other guy. I can't help. I want to help. I really do, but I can't. You know. It's always the network.
Yeah. It's Friday. We don't change anything on Friday afternoons.
Not at all.
I have a strict policy which says no changing the network on Friday afternoons after 12, because that might mean I'd have to fix it over the weekend. Also with us today is Ivan Pepelniuk. How are you, sir?
Pretty good, thank you. Busy preparing presentations.
It's nothing like a little bit of PowerPoint to get you live.
Yes. And everything works in PowerPoint, that's the best thing.
Yeah, always, yeah. And that IBM announcement this week where they announced a new virtual switch, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I wonder whether that works outside of PowerPoint.
Well, you announce it first and see if anybody's interested, don't you?
Yeah. No, I was trying to figure out what switch would support EVB, the physical switch. And so someone started throwing clings at me saying, but BNT does that, BNT does that, BNT does that. And I couldn't figure out from their documentation what VM Ready really is. Is it a software? Is it something that the switch does? Is it something completely different? So I'm totally baffled and confused.
I hadn't heard that BNT was doing anything around EVB Vepa, so it couldn't be entertaining. Also with us this week in the host mode is Jeremy L. Gaddis. How are you, sir?
I am doing awesome, Greg. I'm sitting at home on Friday afternoon, setting up a ASA and a 3560 and some VMs.
That's right. And you'll know Jeremy from his website, evilrooters.com. And he's been a regular attendee at the Network Field Day. His specialty is to drink more alcohol than anybody else.
That's right.
For longer.
Absolutely.
And also with us today, although I haven't heard from him yet, is Derek Winkworth. Are you there, Derek?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good. I should be at home as well, but I'm not. I had to come in and do some lab work on a ASR, some virtual VRF enabled NAT stuff.
Mm. VRF. Oh, you say VRF, you don't say VRF.
Oh, I'm sorry.
NATy VRF.
VRF.
No, I'm happy with VRF. I personally flip between VRF and VRF, but depending on who's around me, if I'm working for company A and they say VRF, I say VRF. I prefer VRF. I think it's easier to say than VRF.
It is. It's one syllable.
You can talk faster that way and get more detail out. For those of you who don't know, Derek is a regular blogger at the Packet Pushers website, and you can find him on the Twitter as @CloudToad, tweeting about cloud stuff, mostly as a grumpy toady sort of a thing, which is pretty apt. So just to get us started then, Nick Rice has – did you raise your hand, Nick? Let me see.
No, he just wrote a question.
He wrote a question, yeah. I don't know if you want to be able to see if we can find Nick. He asked the question is, how do you leak only OSPF routes between VRFs on iOS XR? Who wants to have a go at that one? Derek?
I'm actually trying to – I can't see the questions very well. Hold on. OSPF routes between VRFs and iOS XR. Well, I don't know. I imagine it would be similar to iOS. You redistribute OSPF into BGP.
Hello, Nick.
Hi there, guys.
Sorry, took me a while to find you in the list there. Apologies for that. So you want to leak OSPF routes between VRFs in an iOS XR?
Yeah, a bit of a kind of background. I'm currently working for an ISP in the UK, and we are currently about to take over the network routing and layer 3 stuff from another company. And I would like to put that in a VRF, and I would also like to try and distribute routes between the VRFs, but only OSPF, just as within the IGP. We still speak to the company that we're taking over via eBGP. So I'd like to keep those two parts separate, if possible. There's a whole different background to this, but it'll probably take about half an hour to explain.
Worry probably, and I'm just guessing now because XR is really out of my scope. If you would set BGP communities when redistributing OSPF into BGP, and then when you redistribute BGP back into the other OSPF, into the other VRF, you could match on communities.
I hadn't thought of that. That would probably work. The other one I actually had was a bit of a cheat in just putting two interfaces on separate VRFs and putting a cable between them, making an OSPF adjacency.
That always works.
That's just cheating.
Well, actually,
that's the official design for CAT 6500. Don't swear.
It is, but iOS XR and iOS XE have a wonderful feature called VASI, VRF Aware Services Interfaces, and it's essentially that physical cable, but over the backplane of the router. And the actual interface names are VASI left and VASI right, and they're paired by number. So when you create VASI left one, you create VASI right one, you can put them in the VRFs and configure them like any other interface, and you have transitivity between those VRFs.
Can you run OSPF over that?
Yes.
Solved.
Job done. Move on to the next question. Thanks for that, guys. That was. I was thinking that was going to take a little bit longer, but I'm currently Googling VASI right now.
I've never heard of it. I'm not going to Google it though, because I'm not. It's just not.
I opinion. Just know that VASI exists, but that's as much as I know.
Yeah, it's not a problem quite yet. Thanks, Nick, for asking the question. Appreciate that. Next, we'll throw it over to Brian Gizzy. Hey, Brian, how you doing? Yes, you're unmuted. Oh, if you can't talk, that's fine. So Brian says, I will be moving my WAN from point-to-point links to MPLS. For security, I was considering using a GET VPN instead of a DM VPN. Any thoughts? You want to consider the pros and cons between point-to-point links and a GET VPN? Ivan, I think...
Yeah, I think the way I understand the question is, shall I use DM VPN or GET VPN? And assuming MPLS cloud is pretty secure already, or should be, if we trust the service provider, and you just need IPsec for more compliance reason than real security, then GetVPN is a perfect fit. I mean, GetVPN is really something that you enable in 30 seconds and it just works, and all the IPsec and IC exchange, everything is done automatically.
But what's the downside of it? Is there scale issues? I've looked at these both from a distance, but never had a reason to deploy them. I mean, is there one? You know, when would you use DMVPN instead of GetVPN, for instance?
Well, GetVPN is just transport mode encryption, which means that routing has to work first, and then you encrypt the payload.
Yeah, GetVPN is tunnel-less. There's really no tunnels in Get. It's based on a standardized, well, mostly standardized protocol called GDOI, Group Domain of Interpretation or something. Wow, I might have just completely made that up, but GD is a group domain. So really, what you have is a key server that's broadcasting a key out. It's actually many unicast sessions to all of the group members, and that same key is used by all group members. And so when you encrypt a packet, you're just shoving it into the MPLS cloud, and wherever it's routed, the assumption is that router has the same key that was used to encrypt it, the packet.
Absolutely right. But the key is that with DMVPN, you have GRE tunnels. So you do your own private routing over public IP address space.
Right.
Whereas with GetVPN, you have one single address space. You don't get tunnels.
Right. So you would use DMVPN, for instance, if you were okay with just using the internet for your WAN and you wanted to have overlay, you know, a private network on the internet, DMVPN would be fantastic for that.
Exactly.
There is another solution guide, because I'm a huge fan of BERFs, that you can actually, and there's a solution document for this where you use both of them, use a combination of both. And, you know, if you look at DMVPN config underneath the interface at the bottom is where you apply that, you know, whatever, that tunnel protection, the command that actually enables the encrypted portion of DMVPN, you actually don't apply that. So which you're only using DMVPN for the multipoint GRE part. And then you bring in multiple DMVPN domains into a router and terminate them into multiple VRFs on that router. But all of them are encrypted on the WAN interface by a single GET policy. And there's actually a solution for that on Cisco's website, like an SRND guide.
Yeah, that's true. You can run DMVPN over GetVPN.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Oh, really?
No, I hear it. I hear it. It's just, you know, one of the things about DMVPN is there is a good bit of configuration to it to make it happen. It's not, you know, you can cookie cutter it once you get the templates built. In fact, Jeff Fry, I believe, did a series of blog posts on just how to do that and get all of your IGP adjacencies formed across the DMVPN cloud and so on. But having not done it when you first, it's a lot to take in, you know, at first. And then then someone goes, oh, and you can run it on top of GetVPN. Oh, really? Great. I want to get past step one first.
That's funny. And you know what? Some people do it, even if they run DMVPN over Get for scale reasons. Actually, because you don't have per tunnel IPsec state when you do it that way.
Exactly.
All right. So Nick Rice has got a second question here. Unmute Nick again. There you go, Nick. If you want to ask that second question.
Hi guys. Yeah, and again, a lot of background. We're currently, as an ISP, we've kind of started off the network very small several years ago. And it was more of an enterprise network where we served enterprise customers. And now we're kind of moving on to the bigger scale, and we're going to start doing MPLS across the backbone and start to offer point-to-point layer 2 services. I've heard it bandied about that it's quote-unquote, I'm raising my fingers here virtually, to say run the internet in a VRF as best practice. Is that some thing you guys do? Because I've not really met that many people that work in SP environment, so I haven't really been able to ask the question. So I'm asking you guys and kind of getting some free consultancy, really. I might donate, Craig, after this. You never know.
My wife would thank you.
Nick, it really depends on how you do your internet routing. So if you are an access, if you're running your access network in a VRF, I would say that's perfectly fine. But if you want to run transit internet over VRF, it means that you have to import all those 300,000 routes into VPN V4.
Yeah.
So you're using way too much memory.
Well, that's a matter of opinion, Ivan.
Well, it depends on whether you're selling or buying RAM. Yes, you're right.
Right. Well, I think it depends on the platform too, right? I mean, how much are you willing, what are you trying to do with the internet in a VRF that would justify buying a platform that could support all those routes and move and pushing them around by
yeah, the platform's the ASR9006. Would RAM really be an issue? Because, you know, as we provide transit and we get our global routing table as a BGP session, does the RAM increase if you either hold it in the global routing table or you have it in a VRF or VRF?
It increases pretty drastically when you put it in a VRF.
Yes. Okay. How? Percentage-wise, 15% more?
Well, I can tell you, we actually run in a VRF here, and when it's not in a VRF, we can get two full feeds in, and it occupies like 300 megs of RAM. When we put it in a and this is on an ASR running iOS XE, when we run it, the internet feed into a VRF, two full feeds in a VRF takes 2 gigs of RAM.
Okay, so a little bit more than 15-20% then, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much.
I must remember to do that.
I'm sorry. I just got corrected here by someone sitting next to me. It's 3 gigs of RAM. My bad.
Oops. Okay.
Alex Marcham, you are unmuted. Would you like to ask a question, Alex? Hello, Alex.
Oh, maybe he can't.
Allowed to speak out loud.
Well, yeah, Alex's question is, have any of you replaced wired links between buildings or sites with wireless point-to-point links? I can start with that a bit, because I've done some wireless shots between buildings for the purposes of being a major junction between a couple of different buildings. Fiber's better. I'd rather have fiber going in between if I had them. When you get into... Alex, it sounded like your mic might have lit up there. So chime in if you want to. When you get into using radio signals to transfer in between data centers, you've got a whole different set of concerns. Weather in certain cases can affect some things. Line of sight is usually huge because if you want to do anything that's... that was Alex. If you want to do anything that's a major amount of bandwidth, you need to have line of sight communications between the two. And then you get into issues like up here in New England, we have a variety of foliage depending on just what time of year it is. If it's winter, you might be able to punch a signal through, whereas in the summertime, you may not be able to once all the leaves have come in. So you've got a lot of concerns that way. You have redundancy concerns with the radio. What are your requirements? Are you going to use it as actually somebody just mentioned this in the notes here as a backup link, or are you intending to do this as a primary link? Throughput and bandwidth is a concern. Different, you know, the more bandwidth you want, the more expensive your radio solution is going to be. Security is another concern. Now that you're broadcasting in the air, even though it can be a very tightly focused beam that would be very difficult to jump on, what are your security requirements? So are you going to have a radio that does encryption for you to encrypt that signal between the two radios on the sending and receiving end? So there's a lot there, and there's a lot of players in that space. I guess from there it gets down to how far are you trying to go, how much bandwidth do you want, and what sort of topography are you dealing with in between the sites that would drive you towards a particular solution? And that's
the advantage of it.
And that's a really big conversation.
Yeah. I mean, we used to do that where I previously was, and because pulling cable in a metropolitan area can be really challenging. It can take you months and months to actually get the fiber that you need. And so we used it for point to point to, you know, because we were in a city, universities in a city, and I mean, you had to connect like certain dorms or certain departmental buildings back. And yeah, I mean, all the problems that you mentioned we encountered, and also now you're also dealing with the problems of radio on top of the problems of an SLA with a provider. And sometimes they'll use a proprietary signaling technology that you can't, there's a problem and they're not qualified to troubleshoot it, because it's not just, you know, it's not a wire, it's radio. So, there are like 25 people in the US that can actually really, really, really do that well. I don't know.
I've done it a couple of times.
Blake, I unmuted your mic if you want to talk. I imagine you kind of know a lot about this, your question there.
Yes, can you guys hear me there?
Roger that.
Yeah, we can hear. There's a little bit of data center noise there, but.
Yeah, that's called the lab rack that is killing me with my podcast recording now that I need to move. But yeah, I wouldn't be using 2.4 or 5 gigahertz for that type of link. I would be looking at other technologies such as a microwave or something that's going to be a little bit more reliable, that you don't have to worry about somebody hopping on and then, you know, killing your connections or a security risk. 2.4 and 5 gigahertz was never really meant for a high bandwidth point-to-point link. It's only good if you're just trying to go across the road, because you don't want to dig up the road, for example.
Hey, Blake, how hard is it to get licensed spectrum these days? And the reason I ask that is one of the big wireless projects I was involved with was for a government entity that had the ability to get licensed spectrum, and that's what they did. They got licensed microwave for a crosstown shot. Were they special because they were a government entity able to do that, or can the little people, so to speak, get that as well?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I haven't looked into it in a long time to figure out what's it's going to take to get that. I think as long as you're within, if you're using a partner that sells the products, you might be able to license it through them, and you'd have to have a support agreement with them so that they install it and they kind of own it for you, and you just piggyback onto that frequency.
Yeah, that's what happened with us. That's what we did.
From what I understand, in the U.S., you can get a license from the FCC on 3.65 gigahertz in that area, and the license is around $1,000.
Yeah.
Application fee.
Yeah, there's something similar in the U.K.
So an application fee, do you own it then forever, or is there a renewal, you think?
I have no idea on that either.
It's usually renewed every year, so you can...
My guess is there's going to be some type of renewal, because... You know, the FCC, they want to keep on top of you and make sure that you're actually following the rules, because not enough people do.
I mean, right. I can tell you, unless you absolutely have to need it, use it, I would. We had so many problems. It's a backup link, or it's only primary if you can't get the wired.
I've done this for small customers.
It just was a hassle. The weather used to cause us problems all the time in one of our data centers.
I've done this for small customers in the past where we used wireless to get between buildings or up and down a road or something like that. And a couple of things that I would do is, one is, if you're using 2.4 or 5 gigahertz, get yourself some outdoor antennas. Don't use indoor antennas, because the physical mounting of those needs to be robust enough so they don't move around in the wind or the sun, or as the building stretches and gets, you know, whatever. You've got to be fairly careful about what you're doing. I would always run a VPN connection over that, so an IPsec tunnel, so that even if somebody breaches the wireless, you can have it encrypted, so then you never have to panic at 4 o'clock in the morning that somebody's hacking your wireless together. And keep in mind that 2.4 gig, and is particularly, if you're trying to use that between buildings, is also vulnerable to simple things like microwave interference, or, you know, people with walkie-talkies in a warehouse, they might be sitting on the 2.4 gig frequency to cause you problems. So seriously consider using something more heavy duty. And keep in mind, if you go with microwave or 5 gigahertz, you can boost it for very long distances with the right sort of antenna. So
yeah, you could really focus that beam down tightly and get it a long way, for sure. One other comment I'll make that's just kind of outside of this. I don't remember the name of the company. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, but they were pushing this technology where it wasn't exactly, you know, beam steering or anything like that. It was intended as a long distance shot, but they said, hey, with our magic, we can push through trees and foliage and do all this stuff. Be really leery of those claims. I mean, they came in guns blazing, telling us how they were going to make this thing work, and it just didn't. I mean, they just couldn't make it.
Did they also say that they were contravening all the laws of physics and nature?
There was some of that. And oddly, the sales team came in on unicorns. So, you know, what do you
say
about that?
Yeah, that should have been your first clue.
Line of sight is king, for sure. Line of sight is king.
Yeah, my final note on it would be is to look at a product such as BridgeWave, which runs on 60 gigahertz or 80 gigahertz. And they say that you can get up to gig speeds on it. I haven't personally tested it, but I mean, I've heard of people looking into that as a fiber alternative when they can't afford it. So,
again, over what sort of distances? I mean, pretty.
They're supposedly shooting pretty long distances. I'll try to see if I can find what they say. Their thing was that they can go pretty far with it, and it was supposed to be it was almost kind of supposed to be like a MPLS network over wireless, hopping multiple buildings and kind of creating your own little ring.
Is that, I think, Marco, I'm not even going to try to pronounce your last name. Is there licensing involved for that product? Because it's 60 gigahertz, or is that an open bandwidth? I don't know for sure myself.
Who can keep up with all this?
I'm pretty sure 60 gig is licensed. Anything?
Yeah, I would think so.
And typically you have to pay for a license. Most supply, you go to a local company who supplies radio gear. And they will actually license. So if you're a company, you don't want to actually have to manage that license from the FCC or whoever it is that owns a spectrum in your company, in your country. So your radio supplier will normally, as part of the maintenance contract of running the radio gear, will then pay the government on your behalf to keep that license renewed. So every year you renew your service contract for a 60 gig wireless or a 10 gig wireless, whatever it is, they'll also pay your FCC license on your behalf, so that it's registered and legitimate and all that sort of stuff.
I just looked and they say 7 miles on the 80 gigahertz, a mile on the 60 gigahertz. And this might be your guys riding in on unicorns, because they do have their adapt path, which helps alleviate issues from weather conditions.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. Okay. Kurt Bales, who you know as Network Janitor, he actually tells a wild story where he used to have a problem where he had a wireless network running across a bay.
Oh, that's the best story ever.
And he used to have all sorts of problems with it, and it took him, he had to nut it out for months and months and months, and then eventually worked out that the wireless used to drop off when there was a high tide. And what was actually happening was the Fresnel effect was so that the tide would actually come up and actually cut the wireless signal off. It wouldn't actually cut it off, but as soon as the wireless signal gets close to water, it starts to fade very badly because of the evaporation coming off the water. So it's kind of... It's a great story. So you have to be really careful with wireless, because you know, you just wouldn't think that taking a wireless shot across a bay and the water actually causes attenuation of the signals. The other thing to think of if you're actually doing a short hop is to look at a infrared laser, or a free space optics is the other word that they use. I've used those several times, and they're very cheap. And because they're actually a laser type thing, you just point them at each other and strap them down to the building with big bolts, and it works out pretty well in the end. And they're very cheap because you don't need to license those, and they usually cost about 10 grand an end, and then you're away.
Yeah, and then the fog rolls in.
Well, yes, they don't work in the UK. They don't work so well in the UK. Matt Thompson asks, what bandwidth can you expect from a laser? Currently, they're shipping up to 10 gigabit per second on laser modulated. signals. I've certainly deployed 100 meg, 1 gig, and I believe there's now 10 gig lasers. They're not very popular because they're subject to environmental degradation. So what that means is fog can't punch through. Countries with heavy mist or heavy fog can't get through. Countries which have a lot of heat haze will cause attenuation in the laser signal. And so you may have problems in, say, regional countries where the temperature gets over 35 degrees and they have a haze because the light gets attenuated as it goes through that. So you have to be just, you know, it doesn't work through snow. At that point, you probably want to have a wireless backup. But, you know, there you go. I've done both. I've done several installations with a laser and then had a Wi-Fi backup as an emergency. So if the Wi-Fi played up or the antenna blew out, we still were running the laser as a main connectivity option.
Hey, Blake, since we're talking about wireless stuff for a minute, did you want to mention your podcast that you're a part of?
Well, sure, I'll plug myself if you're going to let me. So, yeah, a lot of us started up a podcast called the No Strings Attached Show, nsashow.com. And we've got Revolution Wi-Fi, Samuel Clemens, Jennifer Huber, George Stefanik, who's wireless guru, Chris Little, myself, and I'm probably forgetting somebody. But so we're trying to do it at least every other week with different wireless technologies, and our primary focus is just that. And it's any vendor. It's not limited to Cisco by any means, even though most of us use Cisco. It's going to be for all vendors, and that's the no strings attached part of it. So we appreciate anybody tuning in and listening and sending in their suggestions. And I actually just emailed the team and was like, hey, we got to do a kind of a party call like this at some point in time, because there's a lot of questions about wireless. You know, wireless is easy, right? You just put up a Linksys access point.
Exactly right.
I mean, it's easy. There are no wires.
That's right.
And just remember, you get to plug right here. Now it's your turn to plug us.
Oh, yes, I will.
That's good. Matt Carter, would you like me to go on mic so you can ask your question? Would that be all right? Let me see if I can find you in the list.
Oh, I'll unmute him and see what happens.
Can everyone hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Hey, Matt, how you doing?
Good. I'm an avid fan of Packet Pushers. I listen to you a lot, so I appreciate all that you do. My question is, I guess I'm looking for a roundtable census on virtual switches. Building out a new data center with a lot of HP blading flavors. I'm just curious as to what you guys prefer to do as far as do you get involved with that, like the 1000V, or do you just kind of let the server guys deal with it with the V switches and stuff?
Yeah, I noticed you didn't mention the HP's Virtual Connect. Is that on your horizon too as an option?
We deployed a few of those with Virtual Connect. And I quite frankly think it's crap, but that's just my opinion. But yeah, we are moving forward with uncharted territory with the B22s, which are the new FEXs coming out that go in actually in the enclosure.
Right.
So we're doing that as far as going out of the chassis, but I guess my question is more of within the chassis.
Well, I would say it depends on what functionality you need first. So if you have a situation where you absolutely need the link aggregation, then Nexus 1000V is the way to go. There are a few other things, like, for example, you can save the config in text format, you can SSH to it, you can use authentication through Regis or DECX if you want to do things that way. On the other hand, you have to be careful because Nexus 1000V only supports 64 hosts in a distributed switch. And you can't vMotion a virtual machine between distributed switches, which means that with VMware's distributed switch, you can vMotion a virtual machine between 300 or 350 hosts or something like that. With Nexus 1000V, you are limited to only to the 64 hosts.
Okay. Yeah, we kind of split it up. We did, I guess, vSwitches and 1000V. The 1000V basically was the, you know, the VM traffic, and the vSwitch was for, you know, like vMotion and service console and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
That was Tom's keyboard. Oh, geez. Tom, I muted you. Man, that keyboard was out of control.
All right, well, appreciate that. Thanks.
Yeah,
I mean, there's different reasons for buying different products in the virtual switching, and it's there's no right answer here. It's really one of those it depends questions. Conceptually, I would always start with the least complicated and then work up to it. So if you start off with VMware's virtual switch and you think you want a feature, then you'd suddenly decide that you'll need VDS, the virtual distributed switch that VMware makes. And then you realize that there's things and features in VDS that you don't get, and that's when you start looking at Nexus 1000V, because each one steps up to another level of functionality. So I tend to sort of take the view that I'll start with the simplest and the cheapest one and then prove why I would need the next level up. And then once I've got that, you know, you need VDS for various features in VMware that would take hours to talk about, you know, vMotion, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, Greg, I would always go with VDS if I would have the enterprise license, of course, which is required.
Yeah.
The reason is that without VDS, you have to define the same port group manually on every hypervisor. If you want to vMotion a VM, the port group parameters have to match exactly. Otherwise, vMotion won't work.
Yeah, that's true. The environment that I'm working in is a pretty small shop with just a few blade centers, and they are running standalone vSwitches. They have not gone to VDS yet, in part because of licensing concerns, but it's manageable. It gets the job done, but there comes a point pretty quick where you're going to want to go to distributed vSwitch. 1000V gives you even more features and Cisco interface you're familiar with. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think separation of duties kind of comes in there as one of those things that's desired. And then Cisco will sell you other services that you can put on top of 1000V as well. Like the virtual firewall, ASA virtual firewall will ride on top of 1000V. So there's like Greg was saying, there's no one right answer. What are you looking to accomplish?
All right. Fernanda, you have a question around security architecture preferences. So let me unmute you.
Fernanda.
And you're go loud, son.
Hi there, guys. Thank you for hosting this. I love the format. Quick question then, which is what I typed in. Do you guys have any preferences for the security architecture for the inter-VM but intra-host traffic? In other words, Ethan just mentioned the 1000V. Are you guys seeing much adoption at all of whether it's the 1000V, the Juniper virtual gateway, maybe something with vShield itself, maybe nothing at all, maybe just host firewall and IP tables?
I'm seeing that in the two environments I've touched recently that people are starting to talk about it. vShield is pretty much just a glorified IP tables, from my understanding.
Yeah, it's eye scanned on IP tables.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it gets down to a philosophy in network security of, are we still buying that idea of ports that you're going to actually secure traffic really through ports? So is it? I mean, if you still have your perimeter devices and then you've even got another layer because you're creating, you know, your sandwich, your DM, you know, your DMZ. So what is that? What is it going to get you then going between hosts? I mean, maybe if you're multi-tenant, yes, I could see the usefulness in having that. And like Ethan mentioned with separation of duties, you get the add-ons of things like Altor, aka VSG, Juniper just bought that company. And then you've got Reflex Systems. And you have that, you can get more granular with policies and who can do what. So that's the added benefit of using those third-party products. But I'm wondering if maybe, like when you talk to Palo Alto, for example, and you say, hey, what's your virtualization strategy? And they go, what do we care? Really? Yeah, I think we're going to have a soft appliance, but what do we really care? Because we're not doing ports. You know, yeah, it uses the VMSafe API and it hooks in directly to the hypervisor, but it's still essentially it's doing a port thing. So maybe you have to decide, okay, I'm doing ports at my perimeter. I'm doing ports in the DMZ. Maybe I need to do the next gen thing for, you know, with actual servers. Maybe I need to start focusing on DLP and characterization of traffic, and I need to start thinking about it a different way with some application intelligence.
Yeah, I think it's in bigger cloud environments where everything's virtualized and servers start moving inside the infrastructure from this place to that place, it's possible to move outside of the VLAN architecture or the MPLS via the VERF where they are. And having the firewall attached to this server instance has certain advantages for people who are running a very deep defense in depth strategy. I'm not convinced, the people who want firewalls attached to a server, I'm not sure that our architectures are ready to adapt that wildly. I don't think ITIL even would allow you to put a firewall on every server. I think it would have a heart attack, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you?
Well, we did. I've worked at a place that did that, but are you better served not by a firewall, but by host-based intrusion detection? I mean, are you better served by a web application firewall, which understands the application? I mean, the port,
oh,
I think...
No. You just opened a can of worms there. You said web application.
Don't go into
it. Oh, boy.
Hey, you know, I'm a big fan of mod security. It may not be perfect, but, you know, I just don't think that, you know, if everything's going over 443 and 80, I mean, you saw what happened in Iran the last week, right? So they were blocking all encryption and the Tor guys still found a way around it. So no matter what you do, somebody's going to, and that's, you know, that's a good thing though. You know, the guys still get their traffic anonymized from Iran, but what about the guys in your network who are trying to look at porn and everything else? You know, if they're using those standard ports and you're allowing those ports because you have to, what did you really gain? That's not really defense in depth.
This is Derek. We actually started deploying VGW in our environment, and we're probably going to do it in mass. And the driver behind it is having proper separation on the VMware between security zones, where not just, you know, at the vSwitch level or whatever, but, you know, for instance, if somebody creates a VM and tries to arbitrarily assign it to a port group, VGW will block that and actually disconnect the VNIC of the VM. So before a VM can be added to a port group or moved from one port group to another, there actually has to be security has to go through a process where that gets approved.
So that's actually a good application. And when I talked to the Altor, aka Juniper guys, they had just started the relationship and Reflex Systems. I mean, the policy part was actually more interesting to me than the firewall part of those products.
Yeah. VGW is way more than just a firewall.
Yeah.
By the way, to give you, Fernando, an academic answer. From the performance perspective, VGW is the best option.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that vShield will trash.
Well, vShield pushes everything through user land, so they are limited to something like 4 gig. VGW does all the filtering in kernel.
That's right.
And Cisco's VSG sends the first packets off host to a virtual machine that runs somewhere else. And then that virtual machine can decide to download the 5-tuple into the kernel, and then it should be as fast as VGW.
We should probably mention that if you want to know more about that, Ivan's webinars actually contain that information.
Thank you, Greg.
So if you haven't signed up for Ivan's IP space webinars, I'd strongly recommend that you do. That's the sort of information that he covers in those presentations.
Somebody has asked a question. I don't know if you guys want to address this about a next-gen firewall at the edge versus a traditional.
Richard, did you want to try to ask that? I don't know if you got a mic on or not. I unmuted you. No voice.
That's actually a great question.
Yeah, it's the question Richard asks, what are your feelings about Palo Alto entering the market for the next-gen firewall as an edge firewall versus the Cisco ASA, the firewall, that defines mediocrity.
I didn't say that. Okay, I'm so glad you said it, but I'm not like feeling the love right now for ASAs.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw my Twitter post the other day where I found out about how they handle eDNS, aka, you know, for DNSSEC.
Cisco's got a new next-gen box coming out, as I understand it, pretty soon. But anyway, what they've got now is the ASA. So if you look at the Palo Alto, which I have not looked at, Mrs. Y, but I think you are familiar with the platform, right?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, one of my colleagues actually had more hands-on experience with it than I did, and I kept I mean, there are even open-source types of things that probably would work better than the ASA at characterizing traffic on your network and characterizing, you know, applications. For example, Bro, which is part of Security Onion, is one of those items. But I tend to think that if you want that the device at the edge should be as kind of – it should be dumber. And you probably want to start pretty broad by just doing some like idiot kind of filtering with something that's pretty simple and pretty fast, like, you know, an SRX or one of the, you know, big beefier firewalls. I mean, the possibility of a Fortinet. I would, you know, if I put a checkpoint there, I certainly wouldn't turn on Smart Defense, you know, and then you have something you're cutting a wide swath at the edge and then starting to get granular as you get deeper in, you know, into your firewall sandwich. And then I personally would put a next gen firewall at the administrative side, you know, where if you have your matrix, your asset matrix or your application matrix, you know, and you've like at least done a level of, you know, high, medium, and low in terms of importance and security, you know, at the high and the medium, you know, that's where I would focus the next gen or in front of the users, you know, where you want to see what they do. And you want to, like, I've heard that Palo Alto can, like, you could read Facebook entries but not post, like, make updates. You know, if it can get that granular, I don't know what use it would be by just by having it on the border. I think it's, you know, it's like trying to find the right tool. You know, you want to use a hammer on a nail, but you don't want to use it on a screw.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a licensing issue here as well. Your so-called next-gen firewalls are bloody expensive, right? Per gigabit per second of traffic or 100 megabits per second of traffic. So what you probably want to do is use a cheaper firewall like the ASA at the edge, where there's more volume, more performance, and then what gets through that then hits your next-gen firewall. So it's a bit simpler and a little bit cleaner, so you're not wasting money on, you know, you could get away with a smaller firewall over time. So conceptually, I don't. I would tend to do as Mrs. Y is saying, which is to put the next-gen firewall at the second layer. The second problem is, of course, is that you've got to maintain a next-gen firewall. Someone has to configure it, and they're usually exponentially more complicated to make go and to do right. And there's no point in having a next-gen firewall which costs five times a normal firewall and then just configuring it with access lists, unless you're going to turn on the application inspection features. So I would be careful. Application firewalls mean you have to understand HTTP or SQL or FTP or DNS or EDNS or crypto, or, you know, you can't make value out of just buying a fancy firewall and then putting it in and treating it like it's an access list on a router.
Yeah, no. And I think you need to use that in – I'm sorry. Did I step on somebody?
No, go ahead.
I think it's important to sort of you have to know going in that when you use one of those next-gen firewalls or even IPS, anything that's actually going to drop traffic based on, you know, behavior, you really want to characterize your network first. You want to get some baselines. You want to really have it in a – you're going to have to account for maybe months of – depending on what resources are available, just months of sitting, watching, reading through it, and oh – I didn't know that was there. Hey, who's doing this? You know, because you'll block something that you think should be blocked, and it'll be the wrong person.
True.
Yeah, false positives are still very much the big problem with deploying any of the layer 7 stuff. It happens. That's just the way it is. You deploy an IPS or roll it all in and call it a next-gen firewall, and false positives are still going to be a problem, which speaks to Greg's point earlier. As soon as you begin configuring this thing and begin turning on all the inspections so you get that higher-level protection, the deep packet inspection to mitigate all the complicated threats, now your life just became complicated. In fact, one of the issues that I was dealing with this week, I was getting tickets coming in because of a different site that many of my users needed to access that had just deployed some new policies and new procedures and new layer 7 application inspection that was tripping the alarms, and a lot of the folks that were calling me, I had to funnel them off to someone else who needed to whitelist them because whatever, I don't know all the details, but whatever new they put in was blowing stuff up and dropping connections that shouldn't have been dropped. So we got way off topic about the original question, which was, what about Palo Alto versus ASA? One quick comment is, I know from a last presentation that Cisco did for me and the company that I work for during the day, is that there is a new Cisco firewall platform coming. I don't have a date. I don't remember what they said. Reasonably soon, I believe, that is supposed to be considered a next-gen firewall. What that's going to mean exactly, what the throughput's going to be, what the different models are going to be, just keep your eye out for it or ask your Cisco rep. They may know something now and can talk to you about it. I'd be asking them about that as opposed to looking at the existing ASA.
Do you see the irony in Cisco coming out with a next-gen firewall when everybody's on the next-gen firewall? Or is that just me?
I'm seeing some scuttlebutt saying that there's a party. We're expecting announcement to partners for the firewall next week. So one of the things, I just want to go back to a question when we were talking earlier about the lasers or the free space optics, with people using lasers. Richard McIntosh says he discovered that you can see the infrared laser using a cell phone camera. So if you actually want to see where the signal is and you've got to tune it up, because it can be very difficult to align the lasers, you can use a cell phone camera and it will actually show the infrared laser and where it is. You know, next time I'm walking down the street in London, I'm going to be looking for a laser link, and I'm going to take a photo of it because that's going to be pretty interesting. Thanks for that, Richard. I appreciate it.
It actually works on all infrared. That's how you can tell if the batteries in your remote control are any good. Point your remote control at your cell phone camera and hit the buttons.
Oh, cool. I never knew that. I'm going to have to go and play with that now.
I didn't know that either. Tom,
you obviously don't change out your remote control batteries as often as I do.
Alexandra Stanovska said, what's our opinion? Do you want to ask your question, Alexandra? I've unmuted you.
Okay. My question was regarding what's your opinion or rant on a recent, they say over a decade lasting hack of Nortel network. So, outside of industrial espionage, is there anything that could threaten from a network security point of view?
I got some jokes for this.
hacked or hackable firmware vulnerabilities and anything that could leak out, because everywhere I read that the telcos are scared and so on, but from what, you know?
I mean, Avaya bought their IP, right?
Isn't that exactly.
Yeah. In the security community, I've been following, I'm in one of the prominent hackers groups on the East Coast, and Richard Baitlick, who is pretty prominent at Mandiant, he's like the CTO or something, he voiced his opinion, and he wasn't surprised. He thinks it's not a question of if, it's just when you notice it. You should assume that you're always, you've been compromised. He doesn't believe that the full details will ever come out. It's rare that we probably get 10% of most of these compromises. Some people were very skeptical that anybody planted any back doors or that they got significant intellectual property. But then, you know, you saw the semantic thing and about PC Anywhere, and, you know, they're mm-hmm. telling everybody, patch PC Anywhere, patch PC Anywhere. I would throw it away, frankly. I wouldn't even patch it. It's hard to tell. I guess I'd be more nervous about voice stuff because it seems to be so, it doesn't change as much. It seems to be more static and harder to upgrade. I mean, it's so esoteric, but then if it's so esoteric, how much are they going to actually be able to ferret out and change? I don't know. Anybody's feelings on that?
I think Nortel's failure wasn't a result of being penetrated or whatever. I think their failings were, Nortel had many other problems that they'd built up over the years to do with, you know, their executive board and a lot of their management wasn't up to the challenge of sorting out stuff. But it is a concern that if, you know, and the question is whether there's context being taken out of, you know, where the context here. A couple of old security guys said we saw some attacks going back to the same IP addresses. That's not necessarily that Nortel was penetrated so deeply that it was consistently done for 10 years. That just means that it could just mean that, a certain destination on that they could have just been reinfected over and over or reattacked or re-penetrated over and over. And the real question is how many organizations are actually penetrated today, I think. And if Nortel has been APT'd for, 10 years or more before it failed completely, then it's really, what does it mean to your organization? And to me, it's a sign that every company needs to have a proxy server on their internet connection, and there should be no direct access to the internet by any computer in your corporate network. And that's the, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not just that. I mean, VeriSign was, what was it in 2010? VeriSign was compromised. They're not really specifically saying what part, because they host some of the TLD servers. They host, they have the certificate business, I think, still. So
sold the,
what?
Yeah,
or no, they sold that.
Symantec.
Yeah, but at the time they had. Yeah, but it didn't come out until a report in 2011, and then somebody found it. It was in a stockholder report. And then it came out in early 2012. So, how long were they really there? What is it impact? I mean, I think this is a question that every company is going to have to start answering.
Yeah.
I don't know if honestly that I mean, it's always possible, obviously, that someone may have compromised the actual firmware or code on their, for instance, someone mentioned the optical gear in the questions here, but I think the likelihood of that is probably pretty low. And most service providers, they're the management networks and so on, or any of their gear is usually completely closed off from a user perspective. It shouldn't be visible to the user or accessible to the user in any way. Other than, for instance, an MPLS, you're peering to an IP and MPE device, but you shouldn't be able to telnet or SSH. That should be locked down to BGP. And the MPLS core itself is completely invisible to you. You should have no accessibility to it. I think the likelihood that someone was, for instance, put some kind of hack into Nortel software that would overcome ACLs and those kind of things is pretty low. I'm certainly not going to lose sleep over the possibility that somebody did that and they're going to take over some portion of some service provider's network clandestinely.
Besides, Avaya is going to rewrite it to suck anyway, right?
Yeah, probably.
Like the phone part, right? I'm sorry. I didn't make an Avaya joke.
No, not exactly like putting some quote-unquote patch that would allow something, but rather if they got a source code, unless they got it, then they may get some easier view on vulnerabilities and explore.
Well, disassembly is so easy now; it's unbelievable. In fact, with IDA Pro, you don't even need the source code now. IDA Pro now has a module that will produce pseudo C code out of machine code, and it's fairly accurate. Yes, and there's a science now, behind reverse engineering, and it's remarkable, actually. If you're worried about, I'm not worried about them having the source code, honestly. Look at Michael Lind did a few years back when he completely reverse engineered iOS using just IDA Pro, and he found some pretty interesting things when he did that. He actually found an IPv6 related issue, I believe, and he couldn't close it, but then, you know, Cisco fixed it, and he did that with Assembler. So, you know, if somebody, I mean, that's really the trick there is if the people who are really determined to find holes or to you know, patch things or to, you know, otherwise compromise something, all they need to get a hold of is the binary image for that box and disassemble it and take the time to look at it. And they will, if there's, you know, payoff to do that. Michael Lynn did it. It's, you know, I suspect it's been done to Junos. You know, it's certainly, the source code does not scare me that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read last well reports that it was actually some high executives' weak passwords or something like that. So probably it may not have been related to actual code, but rather, I don't know, competition and things like that.
Yeah, I don't, honestly, a lot of what I hear about at a lot of the conferences are, you know, you have political hacktivism, you have theft of intellectual property more than you have people trying to plant backdoors. I mean, the semantic thing that just happened was, you know, it was pure extortion. You know, we'll post it unless you give us $50,000. I don't think the elegance, if people are looking for like secret, you know, some 1970s spy movie where everybody, it's a huge conspiracy. I don't think that's, I think they're much, people are much lazier. They break in, they get, you know, they get cardholder information, they get intellectual property that they can either use for extortion, resell. I mean, if you follow Krebs on security, that's generally what the trend seems to be leaning towards, just pure crimeware, mafiaware, you know, selling denial of service for just inconveniencing and extortion.
Okay. One of the other questions, I think we've probably talked security to death. I'm going comatose with the thrill of it all. I just, the sheer thrill of a firewall in action.
I make Greg comatose. Yay.
Well, you know, I've had as much security as I can bear this week. I've been talking to vendors about IPSs and deep packet inspection has been my week this week. So that's just too much fun for me to handle. Has anybody else got any open questions about any movements this week? If you want to type a question into the window, then we'll be able to just throw it open. Anything that happened, like any questions on the OpenFlow presentation, which we did? Does anybody care? Anything like that?
While waiting for those, Marco Pawlicewicz, I think, asked a question about ISIS versus OSPF. And that's coming in huge portion once Greg edits the podcast, right, Greg?
It will publish this weekend, probably on Sunday. It's already uploaded. Perfect. And it's all ready to go. It'll. What happens is we can't publish podcasts too close together because people's iTunes or their RSS subscription engines only check every 3 or 4 days. And if we publish too often, the RSS reader skips a show and then our numbers drop and then our sponsors get a bit bothered by that. So we have to space it out 3 or 4 days minimum between shows, even though we've got quite a bit of content up the pipe. So the OSPF versus ISIS show will publish on Sunday. So strap yourself in for that. That was very nerdy.
That was nerdy.
It was. It was a great show, though. It was fascinating to edit, and it makes me want to go and sit down with the textbooks and do more. So,
buy Doyle's book.
Yes.
And ISIS and OSPF. He has one that dedicated to just ISIS and OSPF. That's a fantastic book.
Yes, I've been reading that on and off for a year now, and I still haven't gotten very far. But I've now started dipping into each section piece by piece to try and get the view of the whole thing. It is a great book, though. It does explain it in lots of stuff. So rather than discuss it here, I'll probably just, if it's all right, Marco, to just flip you off for that one. Richard McIntosh says, OpenFlow still is a source of brain-numbing confusion. Do you see it in the enterprise or just in education testing? Look, OpenFlow is very early. Lots of people were asking about that exact question. I don't think it'll flow down into the enterprise until mid next year. Big Switch.
Oh, Greg, it just might.
Well, it might. Big Switch is bringing their virtualized, their configuration product.
No, you think there's something else? No. I was speaking with Tervella last week, and the blog post is coming on Wednesday. Yeah. And they were testing IBM switches with NEC's programmable flow controller.
Sorry, who was it again?
And they came to a point, they used NEC's controller, the programmable flow thing, and IBM's BNT switches.
Yep.
And they said they have to do a few more tests, but after that, they might start recommending that to their customers as a viable solution. And the I think we'll see that being used in very closed environments where you're shipping, you know, a complete solution, software, hardware, servers, everything, and you need a networking piece. And instead of dealing with spanning tree and addressing and all that stuff, you just plug a controller in and it all works as long as the network is small enough.
Yeah, I think... See, right now, OpenFlow works for tightly controlled and manageable environments. So what I'm saying is in a data center or in a wireless network or in a campus, like a university campus is a fairly inside a physical space that you control most or, you know, a significant proportion of what's in there. Running NetFlow on a WAN, I think in the enterprise, it may well be used in the data center and probably as early as, you know, late this year or mid next year as a virtualization technology, as an adjunct or complementary to or in replacing virtual switches in servers, because Nasir is doing something like that. I think in 3 or 4 years' time, I think carriers will replace CE routers with OpenFlow Edge. So instead of having a PE router at the edge or a CE router at the edge that runs BGP and then marks frames coming in with an MPLS tag, why would you run BGP just to insert the same tag over and over and over? Why not have an OpenFlow device that says, if you match this, then this is your MPLS tag, and if you match this, then that's your MPLS tag? Because that's all MPLS does, is it creates a forwarding equivalence class and then tags packets. So why not just have a device that says, if you match this access list, you know, or this flow, bang an MPLS tag? That should reduce the price of edge networks for carriers. I think mobile phone companies have a view. Ericsson is doing a lot of work in this space to do a DPI type solution, I think, around OpenFlow, which is for accounting. I think there's a lot of options, but a lot of it remains to be proven. So controller-based networking, this idea of a central controller that everything depends on, is just, you know, it's like saying we can build Google and reliably and we know it will work. I think it's just so much time. It's just early stages. Keep watching it and, you know, don't get caught up in the hype. It'll take some time to get here, I think. So hopefully that answered your question. I think
moves are being made here, though. I mean, Ivan, you were talking about being on a call with IBM, and who was the other company
that you mentioned, Ivan? IBM and NEC, NEC.
Yeah.
And so, the company that was actually doing the testing was Tervella, T-R-V-E-L-A.
So I was on a call with HP last week. They have announced that they're supporting OpenFlow on 4 different switch lines, 16 total switches, and then they're going to extend it across everything in their flex network architecture is what they said, just to use their buzzword. And what they demoed in that call that I was on was using a piece of software to define an end-to-end flow for a particular activity. They showed where a user came in, they were authenticated, and then a end-to-end permission set was granted to them using OpenFlow to program the switches to allow that person to get from one end of the network to the server on the other end and access a particular application. It wasn't that what they did with that demo was so exciting as much as the fact that you never logged into a switch, you never touched a router, you didn't do any of those things, but you still had a granular control from what HP was calling prototype software, and they were targeting the enterprise specifically. They cited, they gave another example too. I've kind of lost track of what it was, but they were giving enterprise scenarios where you were securing and prioritizing traffic flows across a campus environment on an all HP infrastructure. So they used it with OpenFlow. They kind of implied, and I think this is the bigger part of the conversation on OpenFlow, is that it isn't just going to be OpenFlow that's going to solve a lot of the network virtualization challenges. It's going to be other things, and what the other things are varies as widely as the startup that's doing the deployment. The question was phrased, OpenFlow is still a source of brain-numbing confusion. Yeah, kind of. I mean, but if you just think of it as a tool that allows you to create forwarding tables differently than we've done it for a long time, it gets easier. And then if you take a step further back and go, okay, now I've got a controller that can see the network in its entirety and can manage the programming of flows on all the devices within my network end-to-end without me having to log into each of them individually to do that, the power of it and the flexibility of it begins to come into focus. But as Greg was saying, is that this year, is that next year? No, probably not. That's going to take a while to evolve, because all of us have networks that already work and rely on specific protocols to make them work. I kind of see this, Greg, I think you were talking about a scenario where, maybe it was Ivan, but you come in all at once with everything, servers, storage, the network, and it's all managed from a single interface, and it all just works as long as you're not trying to scale it too big. Yeah, that's where it starts. And I think it gets bigger from there. And yeah, I think the enterprise is going to have a huge play there.
And it doesn't have to be a forklift. You don't have to take your entire network, throw it out and replace it. You can integrate it. So the OpenFlow controller environment can be set up to generate spanning trees, so it can integrate with your existing network. Or it can run Trill, so it can attach to your network via a Trill interface. Or it can run BGP as a root reflector and cross-integrate. That's possibilities, but it's not here today, right? But it could. Sorry.
That's true. You could do a lot of things, though, differently if someone would just do it. I mean, you could achieve a great deal of the same sort of programmability. You could write an application, for instance, relative to MPLS, did something like SDN using VRFs and policy-based routing or filter-based forwarding. The problem is that it has to actually happen, right? Someone actually has to execute on it. And what Ivan said, I think, was really key. He said it's going to be deployed as part of a solution. You're not going to buy OpenFlow. You're going to buy a solution, right? So I'll give you an example. I think appliances in the network is going to be really a really potential sweet spot for an OpenFlow based application. How do we, virtualize those appliances and for different applications and different traffic flows and get it, to the right place and all that? I could see like an OpenFlow access layer with appliances attached to them and the software that controls all of that, and you're kind of done with the networking relative to those appliances. Appliances are terrible at networking themselves. So Cisco's ASA still doesn't support routing protocols when it's in context mode. So, if there's an application that does that, you're buying that application. There's an infrastructure that it controls via OpenFlow, right? And then maybe some appliances that it's known to work with. You're buying that solution. You're not just buying OpenFlow. And people have to make those solutions. And what solutions are going to make, who knows? And I like Nasira's solution, right, that they just came out with. I think it's pretty sweet, especially if you're running Zen.
Yes. Although Nasira's tunneling, but I think they're tunneling across the core at the moment because they can't control the core yet. Would that be fair, Ivan?
No, Greg. No, you can't scale if you don't tunnel. Just compare the old voice switches with Skype.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but what I'm saying is that if they could have an open flow end-to-end, they would. But they can't get... they're pushing OpenFlow entries into Open vSwitch. If they could program every part of the path, so they tunnel instead.
Greg, what would they gain by having OpenFlow end-to-end?
Well, full control of the system.
If you have a well-designed network in the middle with class fabric, mm-hmm. or you take QFabric, for example, yeah. What do you gain with OpenFlow? Nothing.
No tunnels. You know, I still regard tunnels as nasty. Yeah.
You're not configuring or managing those tunnels.
No.
Right? Yeah, you're not managing them.
But you're saying the Sikorna...
It's not like these old GRE tunnels that you had to configure manually and they would appear in your interface table. The only reason they're using tunnels is because OpenFlow can't set the outgoing interface and the next hop IP address with an action.
No, not yet. Pipelining will come.
That's why they need so many tunnels, so that they have outgoing interfaces.
Yeah. In fact, most of the OpenFlow solutions do some kind of tunneling of that fashion, modifying the VLAN tag or some portion of the, believe it or not, some portion of a MAC address. If you look at some of the papers that have been published about how they actually build, if you had OpenFlow in the middle, how they build it, that's what they're doing. They're using some portion of an Ethernet header, kind of like a tag, or they're using the VLAN tag to accomplish that. And it ends up looking like, you know, all the complexity is on the edge, and then you have this sort of tunneled tag switched core.
Yeah, otherwise it doesn't scale.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. What you're saying is just route the IP across the core, so the core doesn't need to know anything about the edge. So if it
exactly, yeah,
and so it's all just a flat IP network in the core, and then at the edge it gets, you know, the edge knows what to do, and the complexity is at the edge, and the core is simple. I get your point. I mean, it's clearly a good way to go, because that's how MPLS works.
Greg, right? it's like iSCSI.
Yes.
Networking becomes another application, like storage became an application. Mm. Think of it that way.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I'm just not convinced. I'm not sure that building...
Yeah, you hate it, I know.
Yeah, I have sort of a moral opposition to NAT, and I regard MPLS as NAT, and tunnels are NAT. They're all the same thing. Why don't we just have...
I love MPLS, and my bed is four big... MPLS cushions. I said it's MPLS. I sleep on them. I love MPLS. I think there's an inner sort of laziness he wants to bring out. He doesn't, when he deploys something in the data center, he just wants to like click on something and not have to log into any portion of the network and have it magically provisioned. And I agree with him. I think, you know, he said repeatedly in a couple of recent podcasts and in tweets and blogs said, you know, it's the time, the CLI is, you know, we should be looking to bury it. And, as a primary method.
Yeah, you make a good point. If I could configure my MPLS from a software platform, then I want that. That's what I want. I don't care if it's OpenFlow or MPLS or QNQ or, you know, VXLAN or MVGRE, as long as there's a software interface that I can actually get configuration information and say, I want this to do this. And it programs all the intermediate points in the middle. So I can get on with monitoring and reconfiguration and optimization and analysis instead of dicking around with VLANs and interfaces and multicast trees and rubbish like that. That's just time wasting. I shouldn't have.
Greg, we'll give you that, but we're going to write it in Java.
True. Okay, well, we've been doing this for an hour and 20 minutes. I think we're kind of done. Is anybody else got any final questions?
Well, Kurt Bales just said that he got back from being up for more than 24 hours after doing a total data center replacement.
What the hell's he doing?
Kurt, are you actually on the call?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, I'm here.
Loser.
You're a soldier, my friend.
I got home and Anthony Burke messaged me and goes, oh, you're missing out. So my laptop's on the bed and I'm on the bed and I'm talking to you guys.
He's got about Hello. He's got about 60 seconds before he passes out. What's it, 6 in the morning?
No, it's 8:30 in the morning.
Oh, wow, that makes a big difference.
No, I replaced every switch in the data center. Yeah. It's all now beautiful junipers. Mm-hmm. I replaced two border routers with Juniper MX80s, mm-hmm. and everything went sweet. The only thing that died was the only piece of equipment I didn't replace in the network. Cisco 7200 decided to start core dumping at the end of everything.
Oh, that That's the day. That's a bad day. Whatever. We've got any outstanding questions that we want to hammer? I apologize to the people if we haven't answered your question. We've done the very best we can. And thanks, everybody, for joining in. I think I'll just go around the table and let everybody tell us what's going on this week. So let's start off with Mr. Gaddis. Are you still with us, mate?
I am still here.
Okay.
This week I'll be throwing in some new routers and firing up BGP. So if the internet goes to hell this week, I didn't do it.
Okay. And where can we find you?
You can find me on my blog at eberrouters.net or on Twitter at JL Gaddis.
Thank you. And Ivan, what about you this week?
Vacation, finally. So I'll try to be off the net for a week so I won't notice when Jeremy crashes out.
Mrs. Y, what's up with you this week?
Oh, trying to learn a very complicated network. I did solve my first problem.
Okay.
But mostly telling somebody, no, why would you do that? Don't.
Did you see that? That's what I like. A security person who says no. That's just totally predictable, right?
Well, no, it was actually I had the conversation with another security person.
So I'm just winding you up. Just tell me to get stuffed. Tom!
No, it was another security person, and it was involved some asymmetric routing, and the person wanted to make it work, and I said, yes, we could probably do that, but why? And I said, you want to utilize Split Horizon DNS, so let's do that.
Okay. And Tom, what about you? What are you doing this week?
This week I'm going shopping for a quieter keyboard. Actually, I've got a bunch of RFPs that are due this week, so I'm going to be up to my eyeballs in paperwork. But I am planning on posting a blog post about the presentation that I gave over the cloud a couple of weeks ago so that everybody can make fun of my presentation skills.
Yes, no. Well, normally we just don't do it to your face, but that's okay. Where can we find you?
You can find my blog at networkingnerd.net, and you can also follow me on the Twitters. I am Networking Nerd.
And Derek, what about you? What are you up to this week?
Actually, I'm actually very excited about next week. I get to be locked in a room with one of the architects of AT&T's cloud platform that they, I think not too long ago, announced that they use to deliver cloud services to customers' private MPLS VPNs. And I get to pick his brain about a design we're working on that will cloudify our own network.
Hey, I've seen some of the stuff you've been trading documents backwards and forwards, and I've been reading them. I haven't been ignoring you. I'm just busy doing some other stuff, so thanks. And people can find you on Twitter at @cloudtoad. Mr. Banks, what about you?
Oh, me. It's the beginning of the budget year, so now it's time to spend all that money as soon as they say that we can spend it. So I'm cranking up parts lists and... mostly I'm convincing myself that because a particular application I have is so small, I'm going to be able to use Nexus 5Ks with the Layer 3 card as core routers for this small environment instead of buying the big beastly Nexus 7Ks because, man, they are expensive. Yeah. Even with nothing in them, they are ridiculously expensive and they're power hungry and all the rest of it. So I'm working on that, and I think I've pretty well convinced myself I can do it and just move on to the 7Ks later if it proves that the 5Ks are not enough either configuration or forwarding wise to do it. Anyway, you can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks, and I blog up at packetpushers.net, where I will be ranting on about OpenFlow and HP a little bit. I'm working on a post now, and so that Derek and Ivan and Greg can beat me up and tell me why I'm wrong.
I doubt it very much. I doubt it. And I'm Greg Farrow. I start a new contract next week, so I'm off to a whole new network and a whole new team of people, so likely you won't hear much from me for another couple of weeks while I get to grips with another challenge. You can find us on etherealmind.com and on the Twitter is @etherealmind. As always, thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers podcast. Hit the website up and leave some feedback. Tell us what you liked and what you didn't like. And thanks very much to everybody who attended the session and just so we could try something new. Thanks very much for joining in. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.